From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
What are you wearing? I'm wearing a foam clog. Oh, nice. Do you work in a hospital? Nope. Are you 22? Nope. Do you go to the sea? No. Well, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut your ankles off, put them in the bin.
What's interesting is Sinn Féin have once again asked for the British government to step in and legislate for Irish language legislation.
And I turned to my friend and I said, oh dear, that's the man I'm going to marry.
Really?
Across a crowded room.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, are you sure your flight to Sydney isn't actually descending into Perth? Why you should be careful where you tread around fairy forts, and the story of the little schlither that could. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that 8 out of 10 fairies would lure away to the waters and the wild. Let's start, as we usually do, with the musings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show and the host's state of the pandemic thoughts.
Oi, oi, oi. So the place is opening up, it's getting better and better, and then I'm reading this morning that locals in Stradbally are up in arms over plans to hold electric picnic there in September, making it increasingly unlikely to go ahead. And I'm talking to the 70,000 of you who bought tickets, and experts fear that most of the crowd expected at the event would be in their 20s and late teens. That couldn't be right. Electric picnic? Nah, they'd be a bit older than that. I've seen ancient people nearly my age there in the past. Anyway, they said they're highly unlikely to be vaccinated by then. So the Forever Young event, planned for Kildare, September 10th to 12th, stands a better chance of getting the all clear. Why? Well, because everyone there is ancient. Marty Pellow, ancient. Paul Young, ancient. Jimmy Somerville, ancient. OMD, ancient. Anyone who ever owned a CD or a single, 45 or an LP by them, ancient. So you're all there. Being vaccinated now is the stamp of approval to be old. Ancient. Good. What age are you? Nearly 50. Excellent. Vaccinated. Next. What age are you? 52. Brilliant. There's Jimmy Somerville. Get out of my sight. Two tickets. Ancient is good. Ancient is the new beautiful. And not that I ever wasn't, but I'm just telling you now. Vaccinated. Clear. Go. Electric picnic, meanwhile, different story. Decision on the picnic story, which is already sold out. It'll be made by the end of the month. A lot of things happening at the end of the month. Decisions. Can we have a pint inside? Can we eat inside? Such ancient ideas are becoming possibly realisable. We'll have to see. Still unclear whether the All Together Now Festival in County Waterford, due for the August bank holiday weekend, and featuring Underworld, ancient, featuring them, will go ahead. We don't know. We'll have to watch and wait and see. But then cast your eye across to Europe, where live events are set to return with full capacity. Denmark, you're in. Belgium, you're in. No restrictions, full concerts, no issues at all. Mate, everything is fine. Everything is, as the song says, awesome. So keep going. Don't discuss it to death. Just keep going.
Admirable head and sound urgings from Ryan Tuberty on Ireland's emergence from lockdown. But it's not going to save us, is it? Let's go somewhere safer and less stressful, like the Leaving Cert, sort of.
Soundings, the poetry book. Funny enough, Soundings doesn't give me the Glen Rose. I find Soundings is a happier place in terms of nostalgia, with the book marked within an inch of its life, with notes that may or may not have come from your own ideas and head. But Jessica Green was writing to say that this week, everyone who did Soundings for the Leaving will be able to register with the HSE for the COVID vaccine. So there's a bizarre literary twist on the story. She says you may be able to confirm your identity by reciting a short excerpt of Stony Grey Soil of Monaghan. The laugh of my love, you're thieved. Please be vigilant of scams. Remember, nobody from the HSE will ever ask you to name more than one woman poet. As far as any of us know, Emily Dickinson was that one. Well said. Well said. It's a true story, that one for sure.
Now we come to the part of the show where Ryan tells us who or what he loves today. Ryan?
I love the deaf sheepdog.
Was not expecting that. Go on.
The deaf sheepdog who, what happened was, it's an older, elderly sheepdog, and this poor dog went deaf. And poor border collie. Sheepdogs are great. They're full of character. Do you ever see them? They're so agile, lithe, and brilliant. And the dog's called Peggy and was given to the RSPCA after her lack of hearing meant, yeah, she's not much used to us on the farm now, so off she goes. But thankfully, Chloe Shorten, who works with the animal welfare, and her husband Jason, fell for Peggy and adopted her. She's only 8 years old, but this is what happened. And they vowed to get her back to the job she loved. So as you know, sheepdogs are traditionally trained to obey whistles or voice commands with short, simple instructions like away and come by and steady and all these kind of things. But the couple from Norfolk have now trained Peggy to understand commands with hand signals. So they've basically, it's canine sign language. That's what it is. And they use body language and positive and repetitive reinforcement. And the eager sheepdog has learned to recognize gestures such as thumbs up, meaning good girl, and a flat outstretched palm indicating for her to stop. And to ask Peggy to slow down, they've made a waving gesture as if slowing down a car. And the dog is completely back in the game. Isn't that a cute story? I like that. A nice little shaggy dog story for the morning.
Is it a shaggy dog story, though? Is it really? Never mind. Let's talk about Brad. No, not that Brad. Australian Brad.
People with too much time in their hands during COVID can get up to all sorts of things. They could maybe a hobby or I don't know, do something, watch everything on TV or whatever it might be. But this clown, a guy owned a building in Australia called Brad, and he's been quietly waiting for someone to notice a thing he did as a gag. So he's in Sydney, and his building is just near Sydney Airport. So as you're flying in, much like you'd see the chimneys in Dublin as you're flying into Dublin, you'd see the flat of his building in Sydney. I keep saying Sydney on the purpose, because what he's done is he's painted the words on the flat of the building so that one of the first things you see when you fly into Sydney is "Welcome to Perth," just to freak out the man. Like what? That is a lot of trouble to go to for the crack. So whoever Brad his man is obviously has that kind of, you know, that kind of mad Irish twist of crazy in him that he thought would be gas. And while it's kind of amusing, he apparently has scared the proverbial out of people as they're driving or flying in going, "Oh no, I think lads, and then in the middle of it getting into a row with somebody else because of the elbow space going, "I think we're in Perth. No, I can't get your elbows out of my way. It's killing me." All right.
And while you're flying into Perth or Sydney, is there much of a difference anyway? What's the best footwear you should be sporting? Why?
Crocs are still, a thing. And let's save ourselves a text. We know Crocs are important in hospital settings. Now, we move on from that and say that it's people who wear them. And we know Crocs are good if you're in the sea. But unfortunately, I know there's a third damn strand to this. Crocs have become quite famous. They're very famous, quite popular among the 20-somethings. This I know. I've seen it with mine own fair eyes, much to the hilarity and disgust in the house. But now they've got Crocs with heels. Now, if you don't believe what I've just said, you can look it up. It's a croc. It's a Balenciaga, the French fashion house, have a new heeled version of the... Is this a joke? Of the famous foam clog. If that wasn't enough to make you not want to buy them. What are you wearing? I'm wearing a foam clog. Oh, nice. Do you work in a hospital? Nope. Are you 22? Nope. Do you go to the sea? No. Well, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut your ankles off, put them in the bin. Complete with a croc. But they're going to set you back £800 sterling. And a mixture between a croc and a stiletto. A crocetto, if you will. And maybe if you won't. Let's not.
A sentiment no reasonable person could disagree with, I feel. And that's where we end our immersion in the foam-clogged musings of one Ryan Tuberty for now. Members being warned not to go near a fairy fort as a child. At a time when the number and condition of Ireland's ring forts are declining, should more be done to protect them? Philip Boucher-Hayes put that question on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne to reporter Brian O'Connell.
Anne Lucy was reporting, Philip, in the Examiner last week on a case where a company was fined €4,000. So this is what piqued my interest. And they were ordered to pay legal costs for failing to carry out an archaeological monitoring on a large site beside a recorded fairy fort in Killarney. And this is an issue that does come up from time to time, and we've had cases in the past. For example, you know, if you remember the one when Independent TD Danny Healy-Ray said a dip in the Kerry Road, which had been repaired before mysteriously reappearing, was due to the presence of fairy forts. And then, of course, the great Eddie Lenehan in Clare succeeded in saving a 15-foot hawthorn tree from being uprooted. Do you remember that one? From the motorway. So it's a very...
Because it was a fairy bush.
A fairy bush, yeah. It's a very living folklore memory. I mean, we reckon we have somewhere just over 30,000 ring forts in Ireland still. I mean, they have declined from the mid-19th century. And I'm going to come back to that because there is a clear dispute between campaigners on the one hand and then government officials on the other as to whether they are actually declining at a very rapid pace. But, of course, I couldn't talk about fairy forts without visiting one. So I went to Tully Crine Upper. It's in the parish of Kilmurry MacMahon. It's in West Clare. There's a blessed well and there's also a fairy fort. And inside of it, there are hundreds of unmarked graves. So the ground was consecrated some years ago. There's a huge amount of local voluntary work goes into maintaining this site. This is Don Ryan, Philip, and he showed me around the fairy fort, which is on his land.
We're going through this field here, which would traditionally be called the Blessed Well Field, clearly because the Blessed Well is positioned in it. And then less than 100 metres away, you have Listenalenev, or the fort of the children, because it's a graves of unbaptised and stillborn babies. A lot of the west of Ireland is dotted with these forts, or fairy forts, or whatever they're called.
Do you call them fairy forts or ring forts?
Well, the reverence shown to this fort was because of the burial, rather than it having any connotations with the Middle Ages or indeed prehistoric times, even though there was a level of, I suppose, caution in relation to what you might or might not do. You certainly wouldn't take anything out of it. And
so we cut the grass inside in the
fort? Didn't. It was left untouched.
You didn't take mushrooms? You didn't take
mushrooms. If you did, you brought them back.
I can see a raised bank and it's overgrown, and that's where the fort is.
Yeah.
And we just walked over the bank and we're walking into towards the centre of the fort now.
No, what you need to be careful of is these are the little graves. I mean, there are hundreds, possibly thousands.
There's no names on the headstones?
No names and no indication other than there were burials. There's some of those there are adult graves.
And as a child then, would you have played in here?
No. No, we would have maybe played adjacent to it, but you'd look at this and you would maybe clear cattle out of it or sheep out of it, but or feed animals in it, but it wouldn't be used for any other purpose.
It's a very real living folklore, isn't it?
Oh, yes, or even any of those blackthorns or whitethorns, you wouldn't cut those, even though if there was a use for them, you'd go elsewhere to find a whitethorn.
And no matter what the pressures are on farming for you or for our local here, you'll never interfere with this item?
Not, no. I was actually just you see it as not a part of the overall farm. It's there and to be, you know, respected and cared for.
But not every site is as fortunate as the one Don Ryan spoke to Brian about.
There's a whole community of people who are keen to highlight and preserve our ring fort or our fairy fort tradition, and they'd argue the numbers are declining faster in recent decades now. Some are saying we need stronger legislation to ensure ring forts are protected. Now, one of those arguing this is Sinead Mercier, recently co-authored a book on fairy forts called Men Who Eat Ring Forts. It was published by Askeaton Public Arts. She believes, Philip, there's not enough protection for our archaeological sites, and that legislation that was changed gives a lot of discretion to destroy monuments under the National Monuments Amendment Act. This is Sinead Mercier.
I'm living in County Clare at the moment and I'm looking at a ring fort. You know, we kind of had these living examples of protecting heritage and protecting, you know, a whole way of seeing nature that, and I just found it fascinating that fairy forts kind of were an example of that in the landscape. I mean, they've lasted there for millennia. They've been there amongst us for thousands of years. And it's from kind of, you know, farming people that have protected them through famine, through civil war, through, you know, very, very difficult times. It's kind of only in very, very recent years that the rate of their destruction has really kind of jumped quite dramatically. Now, the last study was done in 2001, so we don't actually have a up-to-date record of what's happened to these monuments. We just know that from 1996 to 1998, there's a rate of 6.5% of them being destroyed. So when it, if you take that 2 year period, and that's in the 1990s now, you know, you can imagine with kind of road development these days, or particularly at the height of the Celtic Tiger in the 2000s, that's 2,080 ring forts destroyed every 2 years. It's the state and the way that the state perceives these monuments and critiques them and labels them that is actually the problem. Because whether you believe in fairies or not, that's completely beside the point. The question is, do they work effectively as a form of environmental protection and heritage protection? And if it's a living belief and it's a belief that people genuinely have a reverence and kind of an animistic belief, why not engage with that as maybe other countries do, such as Iceland?
But how can the law on one hand legislate and say essentially that fairies are real?
I suppose it's not, the book is asking, you know, what are these kind of technologies of the Enlightenment that we are trying to use as tools? Are we using the master's tools to take down the master's house? And are we kind of, should we take a step back and look at what actually is causing the destruction? Is it kind of the farmer? Is it the way that the state kind of treats land and property? Fairy forts are also an example of sites that everybody owns, that we all have a say in, that are belong to all of us. You know, these are actually sites that belong to everyone.
Philip wanted to know where the superstition that surrounds fairy forts comes from.
The fairy fort I visited in Clare has become a Killini, so it was unconsecrated burial ground. So you can imagine why the tradition might have built up around that. But we think it was part of the oral tradition that predated medieval times. So it's been around a long time. I mean, when I was on the way to West Clare, I stopped at a petrol station and a man said to me, "What are you doing in West Clare?" And I said, "I'm going to see a fairy fort." And he told me a fairy fort story about someone interfering with one. You know, so it's a really living
part. Everybody has one. Yeah.
Everyone has one. Now, there is stronger legislation proposed. The Monuments and Archaeological Heritage Bill, which is quite interesting, and it will provide better protection. It's going to create a civil enforcement which can be used, so this will be an alternative maybe, or to supplement criminal proceedings, and then you'll be able to enforce that, I suppose, much easier than you can a criminal proceeding at the moment. So I understand that legislation is being worked on at the moment. They're hoping to get it to pre-legislative scrutiny, and there are additional department resources, I'm told, have recently been dedicated to trying to progress that along. So obviously, from the mid-19th century on, this part of our heritage has been declining, but some would say in the last 20 years it's been declining faster, although, interestingly, the department say there is no evidence for that.
Today with Clare Byrne reporter Brian O'Connell telling Philip Boucher-Hayes about ring forts and how they became known and feared as fairy forts. We've all been there. You go to the beach with your come on and your schlitter, and one puck father later, your schlitter turns up in Wales. Wait, what? Well, that's the story that Catherine Thomas had for us on this afternoon's Ray Darcy show. She spoke to Welsh fisherman Darren Acterson, who pulled something very much not fishy out of the water.
We were fishing in Kevin Seaden, which is between Buddyport and Kidwelly, night fishing for bass, and my friend then, Luke Phillips, found the ball and just thought he'd take it home for the dogs. And then a couple of days later, this was a couple of months ago, sorry, and then a couple of days ago, I just said to him, I said, "What did you do with that ball?" And he said, "Oh, I got it in the house." He said, "It's just too hard," he said, "for the dogs." So he sent me a photo, and when he sent me a photo, I realised there was a name on the ball. So I'm a big Man United fan, follow a lot of Irish United fans on Twitter, so I thought I'd chuck it on Twitter, and then it's just been amazing. It just got snowballed.
Okay, so what was the name on the ball?
The name on the ball was Michael Fogarty. He had a middle name as well. I can't. Was
Michael.
Dwayne? No.
Yeah, so there's a Fada on it. So it's because I'm looking at a photograph of it here. Micheál Dhuán Fogarty. Micheál Dhuán Fogarty. So,
oh, it's Micheál.
Micheál.
Right,
yes, when you put the little fada over it, Micheál Dhuán Fogarty. So did you know what kind of a ball it was? Did you know it was a schlitter?
No, we just thought it was like a cricket ball because it was so hard. Like.
Okay. And do you know what? Do you know about the game of hurling?
Yeah, I know about the game of hurling. Yeah, I have watched it.
Okay. Okay. So you decided to put it up on Twitter. And there has been, when I say there has been a huge response online, I mean, that is an understatement. It just went viral. Were you expecting that?
No, not really. Not really at all.
So what sort of messages have you been getting from people?
Oh, it's just been unbelievable. You know, people just sending me links to other people who obviously play hurling. You know, do you know who this boy is? Do you know who this boy is? And everything like that. And then all of a sudden, I had one back saying that his father was in work and somebody showed him the tweet. And then somebody said that he'd messaged him and he was going to get back to me. I haven't heard of him yet, but it's a boy from Cork, it is.
Okay, so we're almost there. And have you been over to Ireland, obviously pre-COVID? Like, would you have been over and back?
Well, I was over in Ireland 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Well, we left from Pembroke Dock and landed in Rosslea and then drove to Belfast to do a fire cert test on some panels.
Okay.
And I'm back over there in August. So with a bit of luck, if I get hold of the boy, I'll meet him somewhere and have his ball back.
There you go. Well, would you believe it, Darren? With the power of Ireland and social media, we have managed to track down the owner of the Schlitter, Michael Fogarty, father of Micheál Dwan Fogarty. How are you?
I'm not too bad, and yourself, Catherine?
Listen, I could, between the Welsh accent now and the Cork accent, I am a happy woman. I've got one coming in each ear and I'm delighted with it.
To be honest with you, I have to say, first of all, I'm not a Cork man originally, I'm Tipperary.
Tipperary, okay. Yeah. So yeah. You're the owner of the ball. Say hello to Darren.
Darren, how are you doing?
How are you, mate? You okay?
I am. I'm very busy, thank God.
Good.
So tell us, Michael, you're the father of Micheál, so it's your little fella whose Schlitter it is that right?
Yes, as far as I make out anyway, because he's about 200 of them at home and I sign every one of them with his name. And he's actually Micheál Óg, which is young Michael.
Okay, so he hasn't been crying into his soup about this missing Schlitter, is what you're saying?
I say he doesn't even know it's gone missing at this stage, you know. But you could easily identify it's him, all right.
Go on, Darren. Yeah, how did he lose it?
Did he go in the river and then enter the sea or something?
Yeah, well, basically, it's either one or two options. We were either, before COVID, we would have been down the beach in Kinsale a lot with his hurling ball. But if it was after COVID set in, I'd say we were down in the local marina walkway and he probably poked it into the water there.
Okay, so it either went in Kinsale, it went in at the beach in Kinsale, or the River Lee.
Yeah, because with the restrictions now, with the 5K, we wouldn't have been able to go to the beach in the last year. So we'd have just gone down to the local marina pier down by the River Lee, famous river in Cork. So he probably poked one or two more in there as well. So they're probably sorting around the North Sea somewhere.
Huh. Kid maybe needs to work on his pucking before he goes near the water in future, am I right? That's the saga of the cross-channel Schlitter, as told by Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Miriam Brady and Ronan Smith are well known in the entertainment business. From Glenroe to Riverdance, they've been involved in the Irish theatre industry for many years. Miriam has become Ronan's carer since his diagnosis with early-onset Alzheimer's, and she joined Ryan Tuberty in studio to tell him about Ronan.
Subjectively,
Ronan, as much as you can.
Ronan is the best guy in the whole world. I met him in 1987 when I was an actor in Cork, and I was in Othello and he came to visit our company. He was working for a team theatre company. He was AD there. And as soon as I saw him, this sounds very strange, but I absolutely fell in love with him. And I turned to my friend and I said, "Oh dear, that's the man I'm going to marry."
Really?
Across a crowded room. And of course, I just put that away because one does. That's just silly talk and you get on with your life. And he went back to Dublin and I got on with my life and I continued my acting career. And then I took a break and I went to Kenya to work on the missions there and came back. And then I got a call from Team Theatre Company asking me to audition. And I... Long story short, yeah. went to work with Team, fell in love with Ronan. 2 years later, we were married.
And I think it's amazing that you'd spot this man.
Very strange.
And say, it's him.
Yeah.
You hear stories about this, about people saying that they saw somebody in a room or whatever it might have been and said, it's always going to be that person. And it's not creepy. It just happens to be this. It's more cosmic than creepy.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's very strange. And your conscious mind comes in and says, well, you know, you need to just calm down now. It's just, you're in one city, he's in another, he's in a relationship, you're in a relationship. But it did, it came around and we're together for, 32 years?
I suppose in some ways, and this is an unusual turn on the road, we have to talk about Ronan's father.
Yes.
Again, a theatre producer.
Yes.
In the programme I was watching from before, it's an older programme where Grace Kelly's come to town and he's bringing her in to the press car. Really, so he was brushing shoulders with these kind of people. Anyway, Ronan's father got ill. At some point in his life, which I'm going to ask you about now, but he didn't want to tell anyone.
That's right.
And he was hiding in plain sight.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Well, I didn't know Brendan personally. I met him once when he was very, very ill, about 6 months before he died. He did hide it. And I think he wasn't just hiding it from other people. I actually think he might have been in denial himself because it's such a distressing disease that part of you doesn't want to face it. So it was Ronan, it was Michael Colgan actually who worked with him, who worked with Brendan in. Brendan founded the theatre
festival. Yeah.
So Michael called Ronan and said, look, things are not good here at all. There's something really wrong
with
your
father.
And so the world really came tumbling down and they went down the road of looking for care. And they finally got him care in Donnybrook in St. Mary's.
And it was Alzheimer's we're talking about.
It was Alzheimer's and a particular type of Alzheimer's, Ryan. Ronan has what we call familial Alzheimer's disease, FAD for short. And only 1% of all dementias, there are around 110 types of dementia. 1% of them are FAD. It's quite a rare gene. And the peculiar thing about FAD is you get ill exactly, almost to the day that your father got sick.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, or your mother.
So talk to me then a little bit about Ronan and how, I mean, he seems like a very charismatic guy.
He is very charismatic.
Theatre guy.
Yeah, he's still very charismatic.
Yeah.
He started life out as a child actor from the age of about 10.
Black Beauty.
And then did some teenage acting, early adult acting, like SOS Titanic with Helen Mirren, his bestie, as he likes to call her. Lee Remick, who he still has a crush on, even though she's probably passed. But anyway, we won't go into that. He loved all that. And then he went on to be a stage actor in Dublin with the Gate and the Abbey Theatre, and then became artistic director of Team Theatre Company while acting at the same time and producing at the same time. So quite often Ronan would be working from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, which is not a great thing. And it is a theme in the book.
Yes.
Workaholism is a theme. And I think it's something that we kind of possibly need to really talk about more in society.
Separate to where we're going with Alzheimer's, do you think it's another issue altogether?
It's another issue.
Yeah.
It's not for today, but it is a...
It's a very good point you make.
It's as important as other isms like alcoholism. And the common denominator is that you leave an absence in the people around you.
Yes.
For the people around you.
Do you think some workaholics are on the run?
Possibly they're on the run from themselves.
That's kind of what I was thinking of.
Alcoholics are on the run from themselves.
Yeah, a lot of people on the run
and people with eating disorders are on the run from themselves.
Yeah, good point.
So it is a psychological thing, yeah.
We'll come back to Ronan, though, if you don't mind,
and
ask you about the point in his life, at what age he was, when you started thinking, Miriam, this isn't good.
He was about 57.
That's young, yeah.
We were on holidays with our dear friend Philip and Una in Clavier in France. And it's just something very tiny, but I just really got very suspicious. I sent him to the shops for two items and he came back with one, and he repeated the same the next day. And I remember saying it to Philip and Una, and they thought I might be imagining things. But anyway, it just progressed from there and I became quite suspicious. And he did become quite stressed at home, and then he went to work on a job that he wasn't. It wasn't the theatre world. It was the Science Gallery attached to TCD.
Yes.
And that's where he really felt things were falling apart for him.
Was he able to articulate that?
Not to me, but in his diaries, he expressed how he was finding it hard to cope. And I encouraged him then to be tested for Alzheimer's.
Yes.
So we went to the memory clinic, had the testing done, and then we were called back to be told.
It's not good.
It's not good, no. Early onset, probable early onset Alzheimer's disease was the diagnosis.
Draw this box. Remember these words. These are the sort of some of the tests that you have to, apply in this case.
Yes, and memory.
And memory, of course. And
recall.
The shuffling of the papers, you mentioned his father, Ronan's father's files and everything. I got the sense this was history repeating itself again.
Very much so, very much so. Ronan felt, actually, he was on the floor in the Science Gallery with papers. And he thought, oh my God, I'm actually repeating history. This is what I spoke about my father. So,
and the sense of cover up, of trying to not let other people know where you were at. Did Ronan have the same problem?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. Ronan was terribly brave. He came out immediately. He told his boss he was working for Caroline Downey in the Gaiety at the time. And he went to Caroline and told her, and she was very, very supportive. Moya and John in Riverdance, very supportive. And it's not the case for all employers.
Yeah,
you know,
very good point again.
Getting that news.
Yes.
He never hid it, no. And we told the children, we told Lachlan after his leaving cert. We wanted that to be done, yeah.
And then
Hannah found out. She was in college and she found a book in my bag called Emotional Something Dementia. Contented Dementia.
Yeah.
She found it in my bag. She was looking for my phone and she was in the kitchen with me, and she took the book out of the bag and she looked at it and she said, "What's this about?" And I nearly collapsed. And I said, "Oh, that's just some research I'm doing for Samaritans," because I was working with Samaritans at the time. And she said, "No, it's not."
Yeah.
And she just collapsed.
She knew. She knew. Did she know about her grandfather's story? And
Yeah.
I get the sense that you feel like you wish that book hadn't been there in that bag at that time.
Yeah, but I suppose she had to know sometimes.
Of course she did. Yeah, I hope you're not being hard on yourself, though. You were.
No.
It's not fair. You say, Miriam, I spend a lot of time trying to protect him, Ronan, from his own sadness.
Yes.
And I have to accept I can't do that. What do you mean by trying to protect him from his own sadness?
I think a researcher asked me, it was Donal Lynch, actually, a writer, what was the worst aspect of this? And I said to him, it's not to do with the coping on a day-to-day level, the practicalities, but when I see him really sad, I just want to, I just want to reach into his soul and take it out and make him happy. And that's a challenge for me because I know I can't do that. And I'm working on that. And I think it's probably a huge challenge for most of us as carers. When I say carers, I mean spouses, children, husbands and wives who are caring for their loved ones. And I'm really realising what it must be like to live with somebody who's very depressed.
Mm.
That must be incredibly
hard. Because the intensity of it.
The intensity and the lack of control.
Did Ronan see his grip on reality and memory and all of these things slide away? Well, was he aware? Was he kind of going?
Totally aware.
Like going in a lift, kind of going, there's totally, that floor, there's that floor.
Aware. He's still aware. And that's very cruel.
Is it? Yeah, it must be.
It's very cruel because sometimes I wish he wasn't aware.
Yeah, I understand that.
You know,
yeah.
That he was on the other side, but he goes in and out of awareness. And
so flashes of lucidity, is that
it? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like he gets very, very down and depressed and agitated.
Yeah.
And when he gets agitated, he knows there's something really wrong. Like he could walk around the house for ages and just be very confused. And that does agitate him to the point of tears. So he knows something is really wrong.
Does he ask you about it?
No, he can't verbalise very much anymore. His language has depleted. I try and sit with him and stroke his hand when he's like that. And he doesn't ask me about it. I ask him.
Do you? What do you ask him?
Can you just give me one word, what you're feeling?
Okay.
Can you tell me?
Hmm.
He usually can't, but I know him so well. I know what he's feeling.
You can see it in him.
Oh, I can see it in his eyes, yeah.
Is it a lonely road, Miriam?
It's extremely lonely. Yeah. It is extremely lonely. But I do have amazing neighbours and friends. And I would say to anybody who is embarking on this journey, really, really try not to panic.
You, the analogy you use of the flight, you know, that Ronan was nervous getting on a plane. And
that I was nervous.
Sorry,
I'm a nervous passenger.
You were the
and getting on the plane and being told by the pilot in a very calm voice, we're now taking off. I would just like to announce we will be on a very long trip together. There will be turbulence. But at the end of the flight, we will crash. And that's just a vision I had the day of the diagnosis at 4 a.m. That's how I was describing it to myself.
Yeah.
There is a crash at the end, but I would say to people embarking on the journey, try not to think about that. Live in the moment. Get as much help as you can. Go to the right doctors. Go to a geriatrician.
Mm.
Go to people who are expert in dementia. Not a GP. GPs are great,
yeah, but
you must have somebody like a geriatrician to have your back.
Miriam Brady talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning about her husband, Ronan Smith, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's 7 years ago. Ronan's written a book with Sue Leonard called If Memory Serves Me Wrong, a memoir of theatre, love and loss to early onset Alzheimer's. And it's available now. Political machinations in Northern Ireland rarely stand still for very long, and the recent elevation of Edwin Poots to the leadership of the DUP has, it seemed, raised the prospect of assembly elections, as Sinn Féin aren't convinced that their partners in government will stand by a commitment to introduce an Irish Language Act. Philip Boucher-Hayes was joined on the Today programme this morning by Alison Morris, columnist with the Belfast Telegraph, and Linda Irvine, manager of the Thuris Project, which promotes the Irish language in East Belfast. Alison Morris tried to assess whether this latest crisis was as serious as some seem to think it is.
It's difficult at this point to tell. We've had so many of these very similar types of crisis in the past. But I mean, what we do know is that, you know, the DUP have consistently, through several mandates, refused to implement Irish language legislation. And then they agreed through the new leader, Edwin Poots, as part of that negotiating team in the New Decade, New Approach deal that was implemented in January last year, that they would, in fact, do a package of measures which would include legislation for Irish language. They have now reneged on that, and privately they're trying to link that to difficulties with the protocol and saying they won't agree on this mandate while the protocol, the Brexit protocol, still stands. The two things, while unrelated, appear to have somehow become untangled. Sinn Féin, I think, are looking at this as a point, as the DUP are extremely weakened at the minute. You know, they've just had a leadership campaign. The party split right down the middle. People are leaving the party, and as they're leaving, they're sort of shedding their dirty linen in public. The DUP don't want another election so soon. They clearly don't. And Sinn Féin are probably trying to play their hand. But at the same time, I don't think that either of them will gain anything from a fresh election before next May. You know, both of those parties, I think, are at risk of losing seats if that does go ahead. What's interesting is Sinn Féin have once again asked for the British government to step in and legislate for Irish language legislation. We've already had the British government legislate for same-sex marriage, legislate for abortion legislation, albeit that still hasn't been implemented, for the pension for troubled victims, because the DUP and Sinn Féin couldn't agree on that either, and also for redress for victims of historic abuse. And now they're talking about the British government implementing Irish language legislation. Where that
it's a fascinating turn of events, isn't it? I mean, Sinn Féin asking the British government to legislate for an Irish language act in a parliament that they officially abstained from as a resolution to a political disagreement back in Belfast.
Yeah, and there's a few different aspects to that because, okay, that could, the British government can continue to step in and legislate on controversial issues that the parties can't seem to find a resolution to themselves. But eventually, if you are a voter living in Northern Ireland, you're going to say, why is my taxes going to pay for that a very expensive building up in Stormont and all the people who work in it, when every time they hit a bump in the road, they go to Westminster. And, you know, it appears as if we're some sort of, you know, errant children who cannot run our own legislation, and we need, you know, the big daddy and the British government to step in every time there's a crisis. And I don't think that is a good look for devolution. And I don't think that's a sustainable way to go forward in relation to how we do business here. I mean, there is a possibility that between what happened was once Arlene Foster resigned, Michelle O'Neill automatically lost her Deputy First Minister post. That's the joint nature of those offices. And the clock is now ticking. We have 7 days until 1 o'clock next Monday until they have to appoint First and Deputy First Minister, or the Secretary of State has to step in and call an election in a reasonable period of time, probably in the autumn. That would be the nuclear option. I mean, we've seen these crises before, and maybe they can cobble together some sort of compromise between now and then. I think the unfortunate thing is the DUP have backed themselves into a corner in relation to this, because they have told their supporters, and they're also in hock in some ways to hardline loyalism, who they've given assurances to that they won't be implementing an Irish language legislation in this mandate, and that puts them in a position where there's very little wriggle room for compromise.
Alison, stay with us if you can, please, because I want to bring Linda Irvine into the conversation now. Good morning to you, Linda.
Good morning.
You're in the fascinating position of living and working in a largely unionist area and working to teach and promote the Irish language at a time when it is a particularly politically contentious issue. Is the brinkmanship and the depth of political feeling that Alison is reporting there something that you're seeing on the ground at community level?
Yes and no. You know, I'm aware of it. It's not touching me personally. I'm in an area, there's a big protest here on Saturday night about the whole sea border and the protocol. So there's tension with people. But, you know, this is being created as well, unfortunately, by the situation with, you know, the ongoing situation, because the DUP and Sinn Féin cannot get this, cannot get this agreed. And, you know, how can I put it? A year or more ago, we were in, 2 years, I suppose it is now, we were in the same situation. So we were told there was an agreement, the agreement was going to happen, and the unionists, there was a bit of protest, and the DUP said then there was no agreement. Then the agreement did actually come about, but hasn't been implemented. And, you know, every time this happens, you think, well, this is it solved, this is it resolved, let's just move on, let's just get this over with, because it's not really a big issue. You know, and the large scale of things, this is a small, petty thing, but it's being created, it's being made into a monster.
And how do you think that people living in the community that you're working in would feel if road signs suddenly started becoming bilingual, or if all official documents appeared in English and Irish?
Well, the reality is that's not going to happen. And I mean, the agreed language legislation didn't mention signage. And we already have legislation, council legislation for signage, which has been going on for a number of years, which deals with signage. Signage didn't pop up everywhere. So, you know, signage is another one of those things that is used as, I suppose, something to provoke people and to scaremonger. So there is no It's not on the horizon that suddenly Irish language signage is going to pop up everywhere, or that lots of documents are going to have to be translated.
So what you're saying is it is not that big an issue, it is just a political football in the community in which you're living.
Absolutely, and it's been created, as I say, if we had have put this legislation through, oh my goodness, you know, the number of years ago, everybody would have forgotten about it now, because the reality is, if you're not an Irish speaker, this does not really impact on you. And that's why it's like, I suppose it's like a pot sitting on a stove at the minute, boiling over and boiling over and creating an issue. If we just get it done, get it out of the way, and then people who don't speak Irish, who have concerns about it, will realise, well, actually, this doesn't impact me. This doesn't change my life in any way. This doesn't make me any less British. I think somebody on the radio the other day said that it's going to change the total fabric of Northern Ireland. That's a very strange thing to say. So, you know, let's just get it done, whether it's going to be the Stormont government who do it or the British government who do it. Get it out of the way and let us move on and deal with more important things.
Linda, on a personal level, can you tell me, who are you teaching Irish to?
Well, the majority of my learners are from the unionist community. So, you know, there's about 300 people a year come here to learn Irish. The majority of them are from East Belfast, and the majority of them are from the unionist community.
And from working class backgrounds, middle class backgrounds, or a mix?
A whole mix. All walks of life. All just, I don't know where these people would all get together in the same place if it wasn't for learning language. And obviously the language is a great equaliser. Also, you know, I speak to hundreds and hundreds of people every year, all sorts of groups. And the majority of the groups who invite me to speak are from the unionist community.
And what's prompting them? What's motivating them? Because it's certainly not the picture that we have of the East Belfast unionist community this side of the border.
No.
As having any interest in Irish, I mean.
Yeah, but the reality is they are. And, you know, and I would say most people, there's a small minority that are very hostile. There's a bigger majority who just have no interest at all. And then there's another minority who are very interested and want to get involved. So, you know, there's a positive positivity around the language. And people come here for a myriad of reasons of why they want to learn Irish. But what I have found interesting over the last number of years is that when I ask them, you know, they say, well, it appeared all over the news. I wanted to know what all the fuss was about. So it's kind of been like a free advertising campaign, some of the stuff around the Irish language. That's just the reality.
That's Linda Irvine, manager of the Thuras Project, which promotes the Irish language in East Belfast. She was talking about the latest political crisis in Northern Ireland with Alison Morris, columnist with the Belfast Telegraph, on this morning's Today with Clare Byrne. On this afternoon's Live Line, Katie Hannan heard listener stories about water safety, and one of those stories came from Amanda Cambridge, who told how she lost her son Avery in a drowning accident in Spain.
He was free, full of life, curious, and in 2019, we went on a Spanish holiday to Spain, myself and my two girls and Avery, and one morning I was cleaning up, and he walked out our apartment door, down to the pool, and drowned, and he was three. So, yeah, we spent the next 10 days there in Spain trying to get him home. And, yeah, or, you know, in a blink of an eye, your life changes and it only takes 30 seconds for a child to drown. And, you know, that's where the Hold Hands campaign came in, you know, in a tribute to him, but also to help and nurture other children.
And that, this, as you say, this isn't that long ago. I'm very conscious of that, Amanda. That it's this is August 2019. So
yeah, the 12th of August 2019. So we're just coming up on his second anniversary.
And how have you been as a family since then?
You know, we have our good days, we have our bad days. You know, every day is different. We have to take one day at a time. And just, you know, remember him and talk about him, and because he was a big part of our family, you know, support each other as best we can. And just life is so short and so precious, so we just want to live it now the best way we can.
And in your case, and I know because we've been hearing so much about the
parents standing at on beaches, praying for their children over, watching their children to see, praying they'll get them back over the last couple of days. But Avery was gone before you realised that he was even out of the apartment.
Oh, he was. I was tidying up in the bathroom and he was on the couch with his bottle and his blankie watching Paw Patrol. And when I came back out, just the bottle and the blanket were left. And I went out, calling him, and went out to the patio area, and the neighbour happened to say that there was a baby in the pool. And I put two and two together and my heart just sank, and I knew it was Avery. And, I ran, and I just heard, in my ears, I could just hear my feet banging off the ground, and my heart was pounding, and I could see him, and I just couldn't get to him fast enough. And there was a paramedic down there working who had just happened to be on holidays doing CPR on Avery. And by that time, the emergency services had been called, and he was airlifted to Alicante Hospital. And unfortunately, there was no brain function. So, we ended up donating Avery's organs and just getting him home here to Cork and Mallow.
God, it's just absolutely your living nightmare. Every moment of that.
It's every parent's nightmare. Water is everywhere. It's in our homes. It's in our parks, our lakes. It can take anybody, It doesn't pick and choose. So we just need to be very vigilant.
Yeah, and you've tried to bring something positive in memory of Avery out of this.
We have. We've set up a hold hands program for preschoolers and creches. And it centres around the ages of 3 to 5. And it shows them how to appreciate water, respect water, no matter where you are, whether you're in the home, you're in the park, you're in the pool, you're at the beach. We have storyboards that depicts each one. And you can see the lifeguards, the safe areas, the danger areas. So we do. We want to make it fun for them, but we want to make it educational for them. So that's where all the preschool educators come in, to pass on these messages to these little children.
Yeah, so this is what's different about this campaign is that it's aimed actually at the children rather than at parents, where most, swim safety campaigns are aimed.
Yeah, we've sent out over 4,000 packs to preschool and creches. So what we're hoping and what we're asking them to do is implement it into their curriculum. It is Water Safety Week, and they will be finishing up school very soon, and hopefully we will get sun, and they take out the storyboards and go through them with the kids. And also, there's a website, www.holdhands.ie, which the parents can go on to. Actually, anybody can go on to it who have children of any age, and they can see the storyboards, and they can see what we're trying to achieve, and they can talk to their children about it.
Amanda Cambridge telling Katie Hannan about the shockingly sudden drowning death of her 3-year-old son Avery on this afternoon's Liveline. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, what have blocked water pipes got to do with shellfish? How have irrigation systems been inspired by beetles in the Namib Desert? The answer is biomimicry, how humans plagiarise how the natural world resolves problems. Physicist Dr. Shane Bergen joined Philip Boucher-Hayes on the Today programme this morning to discuss how we use nature to solve modern human problems.
I think from the get-go, nature has been there to inspire humans. The earliest known technology is about 2 million years old. It's a stone axe that has been discovered in Tanzania. And I suppose since that point, 2 million years ago, humans have looked around them for inspiration. They're lazy. You know, they want to improve their world, but they look at how nature does things for inspiration. And I suppose, you know, we should always be aware that whilst we are very clever, nature has been evolving for billions of years, not millions of years, but billions of years. So it has the edge on us. It's almost always more efficient at doing things than we are. If you think about an engine in a car, it's probably about 25% efficient. Very few things in nature would have that level of inefficiency in their system. So we look for shapes and we look for processes in nature to inspire technology so that we can live well, we can communicate better, and I suppose we can have happier lives.
Let's look at plants first. One of the ones that I love the most, because it's so obvious, was the inspiration for Velcro.
Yeah, absolutely. So this came from an engineer who was out walking the dog and noticed some of the plants were sticking to the dog's fur as well as to his clothes. There were the burrs from the burdock plant. I think people who've been wandering around meadows in our new freedom will have had these attached to them. And looking a little closer at how they're constituted, he noticed that they had little hooks on them, and that allowed them to attach themselves to fur or fabric. And
these things that he couldn't rip out of the dog's tail, but then when he put them under the microscope, he could see exactly why at a microscopic level.
He wondered, you know, he said they're not gluey, so how are they sticking? So he said they must be mechanical, and that's what was happening. And rather fortuitously, DuPont invented nylon at around the same time. So there was this new plastic on the go, and he said, well, I have a shape that you could put that plastic into, and we could create a new technology, Velcro. And like, I think if you look around our homes or offices in the studio, I see multiple parts around the studio here that have Velcro on them. It's everywhere. And it's so simple. And it came from an inspiration from a man walking his dog.
I wonder, do we pay nature intellectual property rights from these kind of things? We possibly should pay it a little bit more respect. Other plant-inspired technologies then, nasturtiums.
Yes.
What do we learn from them?
So I have nasturtiums in my garden at the moment. And as I was watering them, I noticed that water runs off the leaf very efficiently. And that's something called the lotus effect. It's due to the very rough surface at the leaf level. And what it does is it doesn't allow water to spread on the leaf, and so it won't stick. And so water droplets, when they land on the leaf, will stay in spherical form and they'll run off them. And nature has evolved these rough surfaces to keep leaves clean, because a clean leaf is able to absorb energy from the sun and photosynthesize to make food. So if you had a dirty leaf, it would be inefficient. So a clean leaf is an efficient leaf. And so we've mimicked those rough nanoscopic surfaces in things like paint. So there are now smart buildings, so-called, that have paint on their surfaces that have this same lotus effect. And so they repel water. They'll also repel most forms of water-based dirt. So when it rains, the rain cleans the building. So ideally, you won't have to paint that building so often, which they say is an efficiency.
Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at the School of Education in UCD, sharing some examples of biomimicry with Philip Boucher-Hayes on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.